Welcome back to Exploring Jewish Thought. I'm Efroni Schlesinger. One of the pillars of our faith is that reward and punishment await us in the next world for how we behave in this world. And that is mentioned approximately zero times in the entire Torah. That's the topic we're going to be discussing today. First of all, I wanted to welcome everyone back. It's been a long break, a long summer, where I really just wasn't able to get around to doing these podcasts and especially doing the necessary research that goes into really exploring all the different approaches to these very big questions. Now, I said that when we came back, I wanted to explore the topic of the afterlife, heaven and hell, Gan Eden, Olam Haba, whatever you want to call it. It's really a multifaceted topic. There's a lot there, a lot to unravel, a lot to unpack, a lot to discuss. Unlike in previous podcast series where I could really just take one question, why do we do mitzvot, for what purpose was the world created, and explore it on an approach-by-approach basis, this topic won't be that simple. It's not one question, right? It's a massive general topic of the afterlife, and it can probably break up into several subtopics, several questions. Of them, I definitely want to address the following three, and if there is interest in more, I'd be happy to look into more areas. But I definitely want to address as follows. First of all, why is this not mentioned in the Torah? You would assume that something so fundamental to our belief would be. You know, we tend to walk around with this perception of, well, he's a bad guy, he's a terrible guy, he's an evil guy, well, he'll get what's coming to him in the next world. You know, if he's a terrible person, so he's probably suffering in hell right now. And if he was a great person, then he's having a wonderful experience in heaven. And that's just how the world works. That's the ultimate justice system. But that's not actually written anywhere. And so we need to explore not even the idea of Gan Eden or the idea of Olam Haba, which we'll get to, but why isn't this written anywhere? For what reason was this very, very clearly left out of the Torah? Another topic that I want to address is the question of what is Olam Haba? What's the experience there, right? Because our perceptions are probably relatively warped by Hollywood or by literature, wherein we just assume we envision ourselves and we look like ourselves. We just kind of look like this, you know, little cartoon character of us. And we're walking around heaven or hell, depending on our behavior in this world. And our thoughts are the same and our desires are the same and our personalities are the same. But in heaven, everything's great and it's just a wonderful experience and everyone's a nice guy and it's all good things. And that's the reward for being a good guy, is that you just get, you know, a suffer-free existence for the rest of your life. And hell is just, well, it's terrible and there's suffering, but you're still you. You're still you with your consciousness, with your knowledge, and it's a totally physical place. It's just, you know, located elsewhere, far away from Earth, and that's where you get transported to live out the rest of your life in suffering. That's a very, very, calling it a shallow and simplistic perspective on the afterworld is misleading, because that would imply that it's relatively accurate, it's just shallow. It's completely fabricated. It does not reflect the sources or our tradition in any way for what exactly the afterlife is and what the experience will be like. And so I definitely want to explore what is that experience. And the final topic I want to explore is, well, how do you get there? What does one do to get to heaven or to get to Gan Eden? And what does one do to get to Gehenom? What does one do wrong? How much must you do wrong? Essentially, how does God's system of punishment and reward work? Those are the three topics that I want to address. And the first of them is, why is such a fundamental topic to our faith not written anywhere in the Torah? I was recently introduced to a piece by the Kli Yakar. It was a commentary on the Torah. And this piece brings down seven answers to this question. I'll tack on an additional answer of the Maharal that he addresses in his introduction to his book on Gvurot Hashem. It's important to note, though, that if you're very, very precise in your understanding, some of them are addressing a very specific question of, we have this place in the Torah, rather two places, they're called the Tochacha, where we receive all the blessings and all the curses and the punishments for not following God and the rewards for following God, and the ultimate reward of heaven and the ultimate punishment of hell are completely left out. Some of them are asking a specific question, why are they not mentioned here? Some of them ask a more broad question, which is, why is it not fit to mention this concept in the Torah in general? Not just within the framework of punishment and reward, but altogether, why isn't this a topic that the Torah at one point didn't get around to addressing? Before I get into the Kliyakar's answer, just by way of introduction, I wanted to say that, in all honesty, the question never really bothered me all that much. Because if you read the Torah, it's just, you don't get the sense that that's what it's for. I don't get a sense, overwhelmingly, that the Torah was written in order to motivate me to do the right thing. It's informative. It tells me what I have to do and what I may not do. That's what I understand the purpose of the Torah to be. Now, the Torah isn't a book that just talks about everything that's important and everything that's true. It's a book with a goal. Right? It's, interestingly enough, in the first parsha of the Torah, in Bereshit, God says in the plural that we will make man in our image. Which is very interesting, because that makes it sound like there's more than one God. And Rashi says, yeah, it does make it sound like that. God had something he wanted to convey. And that was the humility that was necessary in the process, where God looks to the ministering angels and says, we'll do this together. It's a sign of humility. So even though the reader will say, oh, this is a sign, this is a hint to multiple gods, yeah, you're right, the reader will look at that and he may think that. But the point that God wanted to get across about humility was more important than not risking the reader coming to a heretical conclusion. What that means is as follows. There's a point to the Torah. There's something God wanted to get across. Some values are sacrificed to get across other values. I never assumed that the point of the Torah was to teach me about the next world. I think the point of the Torah is very, very much so this world. And I think that's a very, very significant point. We're meaning-seeking creations. We want meaningful existences. We want to find things that mean something to us, that make us feel important or connected to something bigger than ourselves. Following the Torah and studying the Torah gives us that connection with God. It gives us a very, very profound sense of meaning. It gives us something in this world that we need by extension of who we are. Additionally, it regulates our appropriate behavior with the people around us. It regulates what we may and may not do within society that would impact the people around us negatively, or how we should behave with the people around us to impact them positively. It is written for the benefit of this world. Sure, there's a next world where those who did what they were supposed to do in this world will benefit from, and those who didn't won't. But that's not the point of the Torah. The point of the Torah, of the written law, and I'll make that distinction, the point of the written law, the five books of Moses, the Chamishei Chumshei Torah, is to direct our behavior in this world for the betterment of this world. It's very reminiscent of the story, the Midrash told about Moshe. I believe it's in Shabbat, probably right around Peichet 88. Where Moshe is debating with the angels. The angels are like, how could you take such an important work like the Torah down to earth? It should stay up here with us. And Moshe was like, have you read the Torah? Did you read the verses and think that it was conveying relevant information to you? It's very, very clearly speaking about people and addressing the needs of people. And therefore, it makes all the sense in the world that the Torah should be with us, with the people. We need it, and the Torah is for us in this world. We don't need to know much about the next world in order to behave properly in this world. I don't know that it's a very relevant thing for the Torah Shebichtav. I don't know that it's overwhelmingly relevant. For that reason, the question never bothered me all that much. But nonetheless, there are a number of significant ideological points that that can be addressed that give additional explanations to why specifically the Torah left out the next world, and more specifically, why did the Torah leave out Gan Eden and Gehenim as rewards and punishments in the section of the Torah dedicated to talking about rewards and punishments. Okay, the first answer we're going to talk about is the Rambam's answer. And the Rambam says fairly simply, the Torah never talks about punishment and reward. That's not the point of the Torah. It's not talking about punishment and reward. That time in the Tochacha that you think it's talking about punishment and reward, it's not. When the Torah says that if you follow my commandments, you're not going to have war and you're not going to have famine, you're not going to have drought, and if you don't follow my commandments, then you're going to be attacked and you're going to be starved and there's going to be famine and it's going to be awful. That's not as a punishment or reward for your actions. God instructs you to follow Him. And if you take that seriously, He's going to help. And He's going to facilitate your continued adherence to His commandments. That's His guarantee. War is a natural phenomenon. God doesn't need to make war happen. War happens when two tribalistic or nationalistic or fascistic groups of people have conflicting interests, and then they fight with each other. That's what human beings do. That's human nature, and it's happened for all of human history. That's a natural phenomenon. God doesn't need to make that happen. What God is saying is that if you take following my Torah seriously, then I will begin to remove the impediments to doing so. War is a tremendous distraction, and it is horrific, and it's catastrophic. So is famine, for that matter. It's very difficult to focus on growing in Torah and following my commandments and developing your relationship to me when you don't have what to eat and when you're under constant attack or duress or suffering or pain. I will remove the impediments to make following me easier. But I'm only going to do that if you're trying to follow me. Try to follow in my ways and I'll make it easier. Don't follow in my ways. I'm not punishing you for it, at least not in this world. But I'm certainly not going to remove the impediments to doing so. You're going to have to contend with the full impact of the natural phenomena that await you. Now, what comes from this Rambam is a very significant ideological point, which is to say, reward doesn't really happen in this world. If you do a mitzvah, I mean, obviously I'm simplifying things and conveying it in somewhat of a childish way, but imagine you do something good. And then something good happens to you the next day. There's two ways to look at it, right? You can say, oh, well, I guess this is my reward and I don't get it in the next world now because God chose to give me my reward in this world. We'll talk about that approach at some point. What the Rambam is saying is that good things that happen in this world are just God facilitating your observance of Him. It's not your reward. It's that you committed, you showed that you were taking seriously following God, and so He's going to make the path a little bit easier. The second answer comes from the Ibn Ezra. And he says as follows. The next world is a very, very difficult concept to understand, and the Torah was written for the masses to be able to understand. And so it didn't talk about the next world. It's a concept that's beyond many, many people, if not most people. Which is very interesting to think about, because what that means is that we need the Torah. Every individual needs the Torah in order to conduct themselves appropriately and build a relationship to God and really execute their function, the purpose for which they were created. You can't have a Torah that people can't understand. I would say that's not fair, but it's more than that. It's counterintuitive. Why make a person with responsibilities and then convey those responsibilities to him in a way that he couldn't possibly fathom it? No, the Torah was written in a way that all the relevant information there can be understood by everyone who has the responsibility to adhere to the commandments. And if you don't have the capacity to understand, by the way, as some people cognitively do not have that capacity to understand basic things, like you don't have the commandments, actually. But you can't include something in the Torah, our most fundamental work, that people can't understand. That's not what the Torah is for. The Torah is for the people. It's interesting that he says that, though. I mean, I'm just thinking about it to myself, because I think there are many parts of the Torah that I don't much understand. Starting from Bereshit. I don't think I understand Bereshit at all. And I don't think I understand the first thing about creation. It seems very, very difficult to fathom. The Ramban, in his introduction to Bereshit, says explicitly, you don't understand this Parsha. And by Noach, he says, you don't understand what's going on here. You have a responsibility to believe that they happened, but you don't get it. You don't know what's going on. So I could say one of two things. Perhaps the purpose of Bereshit is not for you to understand creation as much as it is for you to believe in it. In which case, you have to believe in it. You're not expected to understand it. But the second is that perhaps by creation, we can say that you don't understand how creation happened. Of course you don't understand that. But the Torah is written in a way that in its simple meaning, it's understandable. Meaning you're not wrong in your understanding of Bereshit by reading it. You're just missing probably 99% of the picture. But that doesn't mean you're incorrect. It just means that you have perhaps the surface level of it. You have the most simple understanding of things, but you're missing all the depth to it. Maybe in speaking about Olam Haba, there is either no value to seeing it in its simplest form, or that there really isn't a simplest form. Creation, in it being the creation of our universe, we can understand it on a basic level because we know what our universe is, at least to some degree. We experience it. But Olam Haba, we can't say the same. We don't know what the next world is, and perhaps there is no simple way to convey it to the masses. But that's just all my guesswork. The third opinion we're going to talk about is Rabbeinu Bechaye, and this is also an opinion echoed by the Ramban. This opinion I may find to be the most interesting one, for what it's worth, and that's the ideas that God conveys by schar ve'onesh, punishment and reward, is a departure from nature. God says, I'm going to stop the rain, even the rain isn't supposed to stop. There's a natural cycle. But I'm going to intervene and stop it, even though it wasn't supposed to. I'm going to cause drought, even though that wasn't supposed to happen. I'm going to make things happen that defy nature. The way I set nature up is for the rain to happen and for generally natural phenomena to continue like normal. But I'll stop it. I'll intervene to make a point, or to punish, or to reward for that matter. The Torah needed to tell me that because even if you know what nature is and you know what to expect from nature, you wouldn't assume that nature would be stopped. You would assume that nature would continue to go in the manner that it is accustomed to going. The novelty is that God would change nature for the sake of punishment and reward. But says Rabbeinu Bechaye, your soul came from God. That's where it came from. It was assigned to a body. Your body at some point will die. Where do you think that soul goes back to? It goes back to God. That's how it works. That's its nature. That's not a novelty. That's not the exception to the rule. That's not God's intervention. That's how it works. It came from God. It was given to a body. The body dies, goes back to God. That's what the afterlife is. That's what the premise of Olam Haba is. And I don't need to teach you that. That's obvious. The fact that God is going to stop the natural universe from conducting itself in the way that it's accustomed, that I need to teach you. That's not obvious. That's a departure from the normal. But this is obvious. This is not a departure from the norm. This is in accordance with the laws of nature. Now, you wouldn't call it the laws of nature proper because we don't think of the spiritual realm as a part of the laws of nature. But there is a natural cause and effect within the spiritual realm, just like there is in the physical realm. You touch something tame, you become tame. There's no actual, you know, quantifiable, visible, tangible difference in you touching something tame, but this thing is tame, and now you're tame, and that's how it works. That's the cause and effect of the spiritual realm. It's as real as the physical realm. So to hear, you were given a soul that came from God. It's going back to God. That's natural. That's what it does. That's not God intervening. That's what's going to happen. The Torah doesn't need to teach you that. The fourth answer is that the time the Torah was given was a very interesting time in a theological way. The concept of God was a pretty well-known and well-established concept, much more so than probably it was today. Everyone believed in something. Many people believed in multiple things. But a popular opinion of God was the clockmaker approach, wherein we were wound up, the world was wound up, it was created with these laws of nature and destined to unravel through those laws. Yes, there was a God. He was the creator. He's not involved. He's not executing some divine plan. He's not responding to our actions. He doesn't watch us. He doesn't listen to us. He doesn't intervene on our behalf. He exists. He created the world. But we're pretty much on our own at this point. The idea of hashkacha, of divine providence in the world, was a very, very difficult concept to buy into. And therefore, yes, God could have told us that all punishment and reward is in the next world. That doesn't really solve our problem. Then we would just believe, okay, so we do what we need to do in this world, and we're kind of on our own here, and in the next world, we're going to be asked, you know, you were a good person, you weren't a good person, and we'll get rewarded for it. But that doesn't mean God is watching us. That doesn't mean God is involved in our lives. What we needed to hear from a theological perspective is that our actions have repercussions, not just natural ones, but God responds to our behavior in the manner that he sees fit. We lacked that. We lacked that general approach, that general belief. And had God not addressed it directly, it would have been much easier for us to continue on with the wrong beliefs and the wrong perspectives. Interestingly enough, the Kli Yakar chooses to link this with a certain idea that's touched upon initially by the Kuzari. Right, the Kuzari, which is a theological dialogue between the king of the Kuzars and a massive Torah scholar. The king of the Kuzars mentions, you know, I don't know that the reward that you're getting for all your actions is so overwhelming. I'm not all that impressed by it. It doesn't seem to be so pressing. And the Torah scholar tells him, well, you know, our primary reward is in the next world. It's not in this world. And what's interesting is that the Torah didn't address what's in the next world because that's not what people connected to. That's not what people needed to hear. And the Kuzari responds, he says, your primary reward is in the next world, but no one ever asks for it. I mean, no one ever chases that. He says, I've never seen a person, and even a person of tremendous faith, give up this world, you know, because he's so excited for the reward in the next world. In fact, I've seen people who have preferred to suffer in this world rather than die. Why would you suffer in this world rather than have the ikar, the primary reward that's waiting for you in the next world? Okay, human nature is to pursue the reward of this world. And therefore the Torah deals with the reward of this world. It's the type of reward that we're going to pursue. Sure, there's a reward of the next world, but that wasn't the most motivating type of reward. Probably still is not the most motivating type of reward. We're much more motivated by the tangible and immediate rewards, and therefore that was just a more relevant reward to speak about in the Torah. It wouldn't have done much for anyone to speak about the reward of the next world. That wasn't what they needed to hear. Fifth answer is as follows. The Torah was given to idol worshippers, or former idol worshippers, at the very least the descendants of idol worshippers, in a time full of idol worship. It was one of the biggest, most irresistible desires that the world had at the time, including the individuals who received the Torah, as we found out a short 40 days after the Torah was given, that this was still a very, very prevalent issue within our nation, the nation that was taken out of Egypt by God and saw God at Kriyat Yamsuf and heard God at Har Sinai. Still, we struggle not to worship idols. Now, what do idols give you? What's the satisfaction of worshiping idols? If you have a field and you're not getting enough rain, then your life and the life of your family and perhaps your community is at tremendous risk. That's your livelihood and it's your sustenance. You turn to your idol and you ask for help. In fact, idols were primarily seen as the deities that intervened with the struggles that go on in this world. They intervene in war. They intervene in famine. They intervene with rainfall. These are the things that the idols have authority over in this world. Or at least the power over in this world. That's what they believed. And therefore, it would be very, very difficult for the Jewish people to leave idols behind and feel like we're missing out on our outlet to ask our gods for these things that we need. They never asked their idols to help them get into heaven. That wasn't what the idols were for. The idols weren't to help them receive punishment and reward in the next world. That wasn't their goal. That wasn't what they were made for. And therefore, when God needed to respond or provide the replacement or the outlet that they were missing by giving up their idols, what he does is he promises that, no, even if you come to me, I'll take care of these things. You don't need to ask your idols for these things. I take care of these things as well. Not as well, more uniquely, I take care of these things. The sixth answer is as follows. The sixth answer is actually very interesting. It requires a lot of thought, just to the logic of it. God says that he is going to come down, or really he already had at this point, his presence will rest within the Mishkan. And he will exist in a real sense within the camp of Israel in this world. Now, if God will rest in this world with Israel and you can come close to God in this world, all the more so you can come close to God in the next world. You don't even need to say it. Well, I say that's interesting because first of all, it doesn't really answer why the Torah doesn't say that there is a next world. It just assumes the next world exists. It only addresses a small point, which is to say, I guess I don't need the Torah to tell me that it's possible for me to benefit from my interaction with God in the next world, because that is a kal vachomer. I know that if I can do it in this world, then I can definitely do it in the next world, but that's assuming that I know that there is a next world and that the next world is designated for reward and punishment. Once I know that there's a next world and that next world is primarily a a world where I will experience reward and punishment in accordance with my behaviors in this world, then I don't need it to be listed amongst the rewards and punishments in the Torah, because based on what it already told me, I can assume that this will be the case in the next world. But it's there are a lot of assumptions here that are going on, that it's like the entire Torah was premised on you already thinking and believing these things in deciding what should and shouldn't be included. And the seventh and final answer that Kli Yakar gives is that the Torah was given to the masses. It addresses the masses, and therefore it is the punishments and rewards are relevant to the nation. It's not talking about individual punishments and rewards. And this is a very, very sharp distinction. Meaning, it's almost a very obvious point when you read it. You have an individual and personal judgment day. You have an individual experience of heaven and hell. You have an individual experience of punishment and reward based on your actions. That's you. You have responsibility for your own choices. You can make the choices that you wanted to make, and therefore, and you're going to live with them. You're going to live with them at the end of the day. But everything that the Torah is talking about in the terms of punishment and reward are national punishments and rewards. If you do great things in this world, but overwhelmingly the nation does not, this is what's going to befall them. And if you're a terrible person, but overwhelmingly the nation is great and they follow the laws of God, then they're going to get the rewards. It really isn't incumbent upon the individual. It's far, far more relevant to the klal, to the nation. Therefore, it just wasn't the place to talk about individual punishment and reward. That wasn't the point of this. The final point that I want to bring up is the answer of the Maharal. The Maharal definitely digs deeper to just ask the question, is this the appropriate place to be speaking about punishment and reward? And what he says is as follows. And there's an interesting Gemara in Bava Batra. Says as follows, Chacham Adif Minavi. A wise man is preferable to a prophet. And that seems rather counterintuitive because, well, you know, first of all, a prophet's probably a wise man. Presumably very smart. But second of all, a prophet can know the will of God at any given moment. Not, he doesn't get to decide, but he's privy to the will of God or to the future. And what will be. And those are tremendous things that human knowledge can only get you so far. A Navi is communicating with God. A prophet is communicating with God. He's bringing back a message to the nation that God gave him. How is that not better than wisdom? So the Maharal elaborates, really, it's not so much the Chacham and the Navi, the wise man and the prophet, as much as wisdom and prophecy. Where wisdom is a qualitatively better form of knowledge or perception. I'll explain what I mean. Nevuah, prophecy, is a lot like your five senses. It's a sixth sense. When you see something, let's say you see an animal that you've never seen before. You'll probably know that it's an animal. But how? You've never seen it before. Because you know what animals look like. You have a certain schema for animals. Saved in the hard drive of your brain, this is what an animal kind of looks like. This is what it has. Some of them have tails. Some of them have fur. Some of them have sharp teeth. Some of them have claws. Whatever it is, that's pretty much what an animal is. And maybe you'd break it down by mammals and by fish and by birds and you know, by reptiles. You have them broken down, and therefore, if you see something you've never seen before, you know, I'm sure, like, you see a bug that you've never seen before. You know it's an insect. You don't assume it's an alien or, like, I don't know. You know what it is. Fundamentally speaking, you know what this is. Because you have experienced, with that sense, your sense of sight, something in the general ballpark. And therefore, through that, you can arrive at the conclusion that what you're seeing now is related to them in any of the following senses. The same goes for your other senses. If you hear something that's reminiscent of something you've already heard, you can figure out what it is, even if you've never heard that exact thing. See, your perception through your senses plays off your knowledge and things that these senses have been exposed to prior to this exposure. Nevuah works in a very similar way. Nevuah, you can only get through Nevuah something that you already understand. The mind, when you use your wisdom, you can contemplate very, very, very abstract things. In fact, you can think about something that is far more abstract than you can visualize. Right? You're not limited with your mind in the way that you're limited with your five senses. Your mind can take you to places that you've never been. You can arrive at conclusions that you were never told. But you can't understand things through your five senses that you haven't already experienced. Similarly, Nevuah is limited to what you've already experienced. God needs to convey something to you. Now, obviously, God understands this, but He needs you to understand it. Well, God can't just make you understand on the level that He understands. Can't is probably a strong word. God does not just gift you understanding that is beyond your reach. God puts whatever He wants to tell you into understandable terms for you. And therefore, Nevuah has to be in the realms that you understand. And if you're seeing a vision or hearing something, it needs to play off of a level of understanding that you already have. So while a chacham, while a wise person can use wisdom to perceive at least relatively the abstract, a prophet can only prophesy about things that they understand. God can tell you people are going to suffer. You know what people are, you know what suffering is, you can put the two together. God can tell you that Beit HaMikdash will be destroyed. You know what destruction is as a concept, you know what the Beit HaMikdash is as a building. But you cannot get through Nevuah. It's a lacking in you. Or not you personally, well, most likely. But the Navi, the prophet. The prophet is limited by what they perceive. Prophecy is limited to perception. It's another form of perception, right? We have our five senses, and this is a sixth sense, but it's still a sense. It's still limited to our perception. We cannot understand. God could give us any message He wanted. We wouldn't understand it. It would be like seeing something with absolutely no familiarity or recognition with any element of it. Oh, we can see it. What does that help us with? We have no idea what we're looking at. A prophet needs to go on what they understand. And the Nevuah needs to be conveyed in understandable terms for the prophet to get anything out of it. It needs to work from within his domain. What he's receiving needs to exist within his reality. He needs to have some sort of common ground to be able to get what he is hearing or what he's experiencing. If it's beyond him, he'll have no idea what this message is. And that's when we return to our question. Because prophecy is limited to things that are in our domain, in our reality, things that are perceivable to us because we have a schema for them. We have prior exposure to something familiar to them. You can't put Olam Haba in the Torah. Not because the people reading it aren't going to understand, but because how does God convey that to Moshe? The Torah was conveyed through prophecy. It was given through Nevuah. Nevuah must take place at a level that the prophet can contemplate, can fathom from a place of common experience and through prior exposure. The next world is completely beyond disconnected, and disassociated from this world. There is nothing in common. There is nothing you experience in this world. I should be careful because there's a Gemara in Brachot that says that Shabbat is Me'ein Olam Haba. But there is nothing really that you experience in this world that is reminiscent of the next world. Therefore, it's entirely out of your domain. A prophet cannot receive things that are out of his domain. Prophecy works on what you know. It works on what is familiar to you. It works on concepts you need to have already been exposed to. Olam Haba is completely disconnected from us, completely out of the physical realm and entirely in the spiritual realm, out of our world and therefore not relevant to Nevuah. Very, very wise people can contemplate what the next world would be, but it cannot be given through Nevuah. And therefore it can't be in the Torah. Not because the people wouldn't understand it, but because the concept can't be conveyed from God to a human being in any way that the human being would understand. Because that's not how Nevuah works. That's what the Maharal explains. So just to recap, we saw 8 answers to the question in addition to a brief introduction where I expressed that I didn't really believe that this was a very irksome question to begin with. I don't think that the next world is all that relevant to the Torah. We have an expectation in this world. It's to follow God's instructions. The Rambam, interestingly enough, in his approach adds, and I didn't mention this, but he adds, it's very important for us not to know the reward and punishment. To repeat the Rambam's opinion, the Tocha is not reward and punishment. It's just the facilitation or lack of intervention on God's part to help us follow the commandments. It's very important not to know. That way we could follow God's commandments, lishma, for the proper purpose. Not just for the reward and not just out of fear of punishment. Because the reward isn't why we're doing it and the punishment isn't why we're doing it. It's going to happen. It's imminent. It's the truth. And yet not why we're doing it. Our first and foremost responsibility is to follow God. Firstly, because he said so. And secondly, because that is how you live a meaningful existence in this world. It's by following the Torah. The most meaningful existence and the most important and valuable existence in this world is one that operates in accordance with the Torah's instructions. What is to come and what isn't to come, it's not so tremendously significant for right now. In the upcoming weeks, I want to explore a little bit more about what the experience of Olam Haba is, how exactly you get there, who gets there, who doesn't get there, and the various concepts that accompany Olam Haba. Until next time.